WNYC Studios is supported by the community of writers, presenting live online short courses in the Writer's Annex. Upcoming in 2024, Sylvia Plath, James Joyce's Ulysses, and Emily Dickinson. Instructors include Victoria Chang, Robert Haas, Brenda Hillman, Peter Orner, and Matthew Zapruder. Learn more at communityofwriters.org.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Steve Bannon, the White House chief strategist, has been called the most powerful figure around Donald Trump, or at least not one who's a member of the family. And despite all the tensions we've read about in the White House, Bannon's nationalist agenda remains a potent force in the White House. In spite of his prominence, Bannon's own story is a little shadowy, and very little is known about what may be the most important chapter in his development, his years in Hollywood as a businessman and a screenwriter and a budding activist. The New Yorker's Connie Bruck covers politics, business, and the entertainment industry, and she's been reporting on Bannon's time in Hollywood, and she talked with executive editor Dorothy Wickenden.
So I want to ask you about Steve Bannon and why you chose to write about Bannon's Hollywood years. How do they help us understand the man who, until recently, really was the second in charge in the White House, as far as we could tell?
Well, at the start, I thought it would be interesting because I knew that he had been in Hollywood for most of his career. He came out in 1987 and was here until just a couple years ago. But there was very little that had been written about it. So the bulk of his career, it was kind of a blank.
How do people in Hollywood, how did they, when you spoke to them, how did they remember who he was at the time?
Well, that was what was so interesting was as I started asking around, people mainly didn't really remember him at all. I mean, Barry Diller said, you know, neither I nor the people I know ever heard of him in his so-called Hollywood period.
Which was most of his career.
That was the first time that I thought, whoa, that's interesting.
Yeah. And that was most of it. That was, well, you know, more than 20 years.
Yes, more than 20 years. And then I spoke to people who had, actually, most of the people that you would think of as sort of major Hollywood figures, they said the same thing that Barry Diller did, that they had not been aware of him then, and the people they knew had not been aware of him.
So when he first got to Hollywood in the late 80s, he came through Goldman Sachs. What work did he start out doing? It was more on the business end of Hollywood.
Yeah, he came as an investment banker from Goldman Sachs. He'd just been at the firm briefly, a couple of years, and they sent him out to try to build up their entertainment business in Hollywood. So that was what he was doing. He was calling on small companies, trying to raise money for them. He started out with Tom Mount, who had been a big executive at Universal for years, and he had opened his own production company. And so Bannon offered to raise money for him.
And also, he has executive producer credits on The Indian Runner, which was directed by Sean Penn, and Julie Taymor's Titus. How involved was he in those films on the creative side?
He was not at all involved on the creative side. The Indian Runner, he demanded of Mount, because he had raised money for it, that he be given a role, so he became a producer. But he had nothing to do with the creative side of the movie. And Julie Taymor, again, I believe that he got a producer credit, but she has been very adamant that he had nothing to do with the movie. She actually said she didn't know he'd been involved until she saw his name on a poster.
So what did you make of this as you began to delve deeper into the reporting, that there is something here interesting going on here about the way in which he is a self-invented man and the role that the media has played in reinforcing that idea of him as someone who moved from success to success?
Right. Well, of course, Hollywood is the place for reinventing yourself. And so I did think that, you know, in a way he'd come to the right place. But yes, I mean, that wasn't apparent early in my reporting. I just didn't know what I was looking at, you know. But over time, it became clear that, he was, one story described him as being part of Hollywood moguldom, and nothing could be further from the truth.
So one of the more widely repeated stories about Bannon is that he has made millions of dollars on Seinfeld royalties. Tell us about that, and why is it so hard to put together how much money he actually made in that deal?
Well, it's a very puzzling story because obviously, yes, that is what he has said. He said it for the first time publicly in that story in Bloomberg Businessweek back in October 2015. He said, and this much I did find confirmation of, he said that in 1993, when Castle Rock, which was the production company that did Seinfeld, when Castle Rock was being acquired by Ted Turner, he was representing Westinghouse, which was a minority owner of Castle Rock. He was their investment banker. And he said that in addition to cash, they were offered a package, an interest in a package of TV shows from Castle Rock. And one of those TV shows was Seinfeld. And at this point, this was 1993, so it was a very popular show, but it was still a bit of a gamble that it would be worth something. In any event, he said that he encouraged Westinghouse to take that deal, and that Westinghouse executive said to him, well, if you think it's so great, why don't you take a piece of it in lieu of your fee or part of your fee? And I did speak to people who believe that he, in all likelihood, struck that deal. The mystery was why I couldn't find people who were aware that any profit participation statements had gone to Bannon. None of the companies involved, the people who worked there, who worked in those relevant departments, had not seen payments to Bannon.
We should also note that Bannon did make money from Seinfeld, but just evidently not as much as he has indicated he did. He also recently told the Washington Post that later in the 90s, I believe, he was involved in the acquisition of the film studio PolyGram. Could you tell us about that?
Right. Well, he said to the Washington Post that he brought in Prince Al-Waleed bin Talal, who is an extremely credible and, you know, very wealthy Saudi prince. So had the prince wanted to acquire PolyGram, maybe it was credible that he could have. But the thing is that as I talked to people who were involved in that deal, no one remembered that the prince had been a bidder or that Bannon was involved. Now, I do think that it's likely, since he described it as one of his biggest deals to the Washington Post, I think that probably he did at some point speak to someone at PolyGram and say that maybe the prince, you know, was interested. I don't think any of these things are made up out of whole cloth. I think there's an element truth. But I think that then comes wild exaggeration.
It all sounds very Trumpian, much of this.
Mm-hmm. The parallels are really immense.
Another reason it's interesting to think about all of this right now, and this is probably a good segue to have you tell us about his film, Bannon's film about Ronald Reagan, In the Face of Evil. which you really describe in the piece as a turning point in his career, the point where he shifts from a so-called Hollywood player to a right-wing activist.
Ronald Reagan, a riddle wrapped in mystery inside an enigma. Hero to the religious right, but quiet in his own beliefs. High profile, though he preferred a private life. A man whose friends were few, but carefully chosen. The only true outsider elected in the century. A radical, with extreme views on the role of government, the size of the state, taxes, and how to confront the beast.
Right. When people, friends of his that I've talked to look back and try to figure out how he went from this guy who, as one of them said, was just always trying to make a buck, and on the periphery and dying to be in the elite, but not able to be and so forth. When they try to figure out how he went from that to the ideologue that he is today, they do point to the Reagan film. The guy who brought it to him, his name is Tim Watkins. Initially, it was just going to be like a straight biopic, but that once he started working with Bannon and after 9/11, something clicked in the two of them that this was about, you know, good and evil. And in the film, they have a coda in which they talk about the beast and there are Muslims praying. It's clear that at that point, Bannon had started focusing. What he now talks about is holy war, and which is, I think, arguably the thing he cares about the most. I think, you know, it started, that fixation started there. It grew a lot from then, but it started there.
That was the Reagan movie, despite Bannon's hopes, was not a popular success, but it was embraced by this small group of conservatives in Hollywood. Could you tell us a little bit about them?
Right. Well, they had they were people who had felt for many years that Hollywood obviously was controlled by people who were different than they were, and their ideas. They wanted to get movies made that reflected Christian values and traditional values, and they were extremely, extremely frustrated. So Bannon, of course, unsurprisingly, he shared that anger at the elite. He was maybe more angry than many of them, and so he banded together with them, and they had high hopes. He talked at the time about how they were the peasants, you know, with the pitchforks going against the castle. He used inflammatory language at the time, and he talked about Sodom, how Hollywood was Sodom and Gomorrah, and the pipes of Hollywood, sewer pipes, had to be cleansed, and it was the culture of death as opposed to the culture of life. He
sort of an early version of American Carnage.
Early version, yeah. Exactly. Early version of American Carnage, but it didn't go anywhere. It's even now, looking back at it, his rhetoric was obviously inflated. But you know, but that was, yes, he grabbed onto that and to those people. But then it all just sort of faded away. Nothing changed in Hollywood, and Bannon moved on.
Final question: he wanted to destroy the Hollywood establishment and failed. Do you think he's somewhat on the outs in the White House? Do you think he will fail in the White House to destroy the Washington establishment?
I think he will. Certainly, he never displayed any skills at getting along with a large group of people, managers, you know, or the kind of thing that he would have to do in the White House. A friend of his pointed this out to me. He said Steve just likes to sort of give orders and move on it, and he doesn't want to be massaging all these different people's egos and getting people to compromise, and you know, that's not his skill. So that was somebody who admires him a great deal and was putting it in the positive way. But his history, which is repeated failure and just moving from place to place, from deal to deal, does not suggest that somehow today in the White House, he's going to emerge triumphant.
Thank you so much, Connie.
Oh, thank you, Dorothy.
That's staff writer Connie Bruck speaking with The New Yorker's Dorothy Wickenden.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.